And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. And we have an exciting show this evening. We have Don Ledger, and he's going to be talking about the Shag Harbor incident. I think it's one of the most intriguing cases on record. I'm excited to talk about that. Before that, we have Alejandro Rojas coming up with the UFO updates and just a minute. And I want to thank everyone that supports the show. We are now live on YouTube. And if you want to watch the show, that is, we are live every Wednesdays at 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you can't support our show and you'd still like to hear the whole show, you can, of course, watch it live. Or you can also go over to the Dark Matter Digital Network. And that's Thursday evenings from 10 to midnight. There's another radio station that plays our show in full, and I will get you that information. I'm not sure of the time. Our date, but I will get you that information as well. That's it for me. Alejandro, how you doing?
I am well.
And you're going on a little R&R. That's coming up pretty soon, yes?
Yes. Yeah, in just a couple weeks. Very exciting. So the week after next, so it can't come soon enough. And luckily, next week is a short one because of Memorial Day. But I will be going on a cruise, sailing the seven seas. Actually, I'll only be sailing one. Maybe two, actually. I don't know if it's a sea, the Gulf. I think it is, the Sea of Cortez. So, yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's great. Awesome. So I have kind of an announcement, too, for everybody. Is up. And the mid-June, I'm going to be heading overseas again. And this time... I'm going for 42 days, which is a long time.
Whoa.
I know. I should be more excited about it because I will be going to like Crimea and places like that. But I think I'm going to, for my own sanity, I'm going to try. I might run the show on YouTube because I don't have a radio schedule like I used to. So I might run the show on YouTube, which would be 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You know, during the day. And I don't know how people are going to like that, but hopefully they'll come back. But I think instead of me getting up at 4:30 in the morning or 4 o'clock in the morning, whenever it was I was doing that last year, I might just do the show at 8 o'clock in Russia, which is 1 o'clock in the Eastern Standard Time. So that is something, it's not in stone. Matter of fact, you're welcome to email me at martin@podcastufo if you have some negative or positive feedback about that.
So you know, if you did that, I would probably be able to join like live on the video.
Oh man,
that'd be fun.
That would be really great because I know it's really hard for you to do that now,
mm-hmm.
and you can only do it every once in a while. So
yeah,
that would be awesome. That would really
yeah.
I mean,
because I'm so busy and I hate to say that I hate it when people are like, "Oh no, you're really busy." Everybody's really busy. So I don't mean to say I'm busier than anybody else. We all have busy lives. But that I really have to turn down a lot of shows these days, especially in the evening, because I've got to like, you know, make sure I have time for family and stuff. And and so that's what makes it hard to do the evening stuff. But during the day is a lot better for me. So that would be a lot of fun.
We will stay in touch on that. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So anything going on? There are some things going on in the UFO world. I saw your blog today.
Yeah.
You want to talk about that first? Kurt Russell?
Oh. want to talk about that last. Now you just gave
like
up
I
my...
said, you want to talk about that last, Kurt Russell?
Yeah. But now you gave away the big secret. But that's okay. People probably, some people know. But what I want to talk about first, it actually pertains to your guest.
Oh.
Because you're talking about Shag Harbor, and there's some Shag Harbor news.
That's right.
Yeah, you ready for this
I'm
one?
I'm ready. Yeah.
So Shag Harbor was a famous UFO incident. And in fact, the Canadian government has some information about this on their site. They have, the Canadian government has an official, like a UFO website, and where they talk about a lot of UFO stuff and the Canadian government's, you know, researching of UFOs, which only lasted a short period of time. Really interesting stuff. And so they do have a description and a file on the Shag Harbor event. And I've got the link and I've got that information posted here. But essentially on October 4th, 1967, you know, the civilians and some Canadian mounted police saw this object go into Shag Harbor. And you'll be able to see more about that. They never figure out what the heck it was. And it's often referred to as Canada's Roswell. Of course, you're going to hear a lot more about this from Don Ledger details, so he can get into that. But in order to memorialize the event, there was a group of people trying to do a 50th anniversary of this event in October, you know, just prior to October 4th when the event took place. They're called the Shag Harbor UFO Incident Society. They were hoping to get a grant from Canada's Department of Communities, Culture, and Heritage. They were sure they were going to get this grant, but they found out recently they were denied. So they were really sad. A story came out in the local paper and how they were bummed and you know, they're just going to have to rethink things. They still want to do something, but their budget is severely hampered, and what they'll be able to do will be hampered. And out of nowhere, luckily, a mysterious donor read that article and decided to donate the money they need. So happily, they sent us a press release. I'm sure they sent this to others, but they sent OpenMinds.tv a press release about this and that they're happy that things will be continuing. So they got an anonymous donor, and they said this donor is a UFO researcher, and this is very mysterious. This donor said that they didn't want anybody to know who their identity was, but they did have a public statement to make. And wait till you hear this one. So this is what the donor says. Although there is much I can't reveal, without any hesitation, I can say the Canadian government and the international community it answers to appears to be concealing what happened in and around the waters of Shag Harbor, Canada, on October 4th, 1967. People with the connections, notoriety, and finances are working hard to challenge how we view the world around us. Shag Harbor is one of the smoking guns that will be used to achieve this.
Excellent. Wow. I actually got an email from the vice president of the Shag Harbor Incident Society.
Oh, you probably got the press release too then.
Well, I got an email directly from, I guess I'll say his first name, Brock.
Yeah, that's who I got it from.
Yep. And basically, he saw that I was covering the Shag Harbor incident with Don, and also I did recently with Jordan Bonaparte. So he said, "Hey, look, you're welcome to come on up to our, you know, to our conference." So,
sure.
You know what? I think I'm going to do it.
Really? Are you that far? I mean, you are.
I can drive. You know,
oh,
it's like
wow.
it's like probably a good day and a half drive. I mean, just to go
Whoa.
North in Maine, they say take 7 hours from to hit the Canadian border from Maine. It's a big state. So so I'm thinking it's maybe a day or day, you know, maybe a little bit longer than a day drive. And you know what? Darn it. I think I'm going to do it.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Maybe do a show or something from there.
Yeah, you're dedicated.
Yes,
that's a long drive.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Do that. That'll be really cool to tell us how it goes.
I think I will.
Yeah.
So what else is happening?
So what else? Another piece of information that we received. We have just such great friends all around the world. And this one is from Andreas Mueller. He is an occasional contributor from Germany. He actually runs his own website that covers the paranormal and what he calls frontier sciences, and called GRIWI, essentially. But he had some exclusive news that actually has made news and of all places, unfortunately, largely the British tabloids, which we do not like because they usually screw stuff up. But and Nick Pope spoke with him. He's always working with these damn tabloids, even though they blow things out of proportion. But anyway, the story was this, that remember those 18 files? So the British government released all their UFO files in batches over many years. The last batch to come out in 2013. Well, during this period of time they were releasing these batches, John Burroughs, one of the witnesses of the Rendlesham Forest incident, a famous UFO sighting that happened at a in Britain at a base there that was a U.S. Air Force base. They were leasing the base. And he wanted to find out more information. He's been researching to find a government documents on his sighting. And he wanted these particular government documents. He asked the UK government for them. They said, well, we're releasing the documents. You're going to have to wait. It's going to be in there. Well, when the last batch came out, they weren't there. So he said, hey, guys, where are these files? They have they pretty much stonewalled them. And finally, a British citizen had read a story about Burroughs and trying to get these files. So he asked the UK government, where are these files? And the UK government publicly actually answered his request and said, oh, we're sorry. I guess we do have some more UFO files. We didn't release them all. And we'll get those out to you shortly. This was in 2014. Actually, they said it would probably take 9 months to get them out. 2014. They've been delaying ever since. So people keep asking, where are these files? Where are these files? Even the House of Lords, one of the ministers said, where are these files? When they asked the Department of the Ministry of Defense, they keep saying, oh, we're going to release them. We're going to release them. Well, the last date they were supposed to come out was March, this March. They said that we'll finally have them out in March. Well, lo and behold, March comes and goes, and there are no files. So Andreas Mueller, he pegged the UK government. He said, hey, guys, where are these files? He said they're going to be out in March. They're not out. They responded and they said, due to the upcoming election here in the UK and the rules relating to government departments during the pre-election period, the files will not be released until after the election. We are working to ensure that the files are ready for release as soon after this period as possible, hopefully around the middle of June.
Well, you know, in a way, I know they keep putting it off, but in a way, I can see that, well, it'd be kind of exciting if they cause a stir, but, you know, that's got to be the reason. They just don't want to deal with any controversies around election time. I guess I get that part.
I cannot believe you're making excuses for the UK's withholding these files.
Well, you know, if they stuck to the March thing, it probably would have been just fine, right?
Yeah, why couldn't they do it? I mean, it's now been 3 years.
Yeah.
For goodness sakes.
If they delay it again, they really have no excuse for it, really.
Yeah. And you know, at this point, since they've delayed every single time they were supposed to come out, I mean, the confidence level that they actually will come out in June, at least for me, is pretty low. So there's no saying.
Do they have a similar regulation in England as they do in the United States as far as the Freedom of Information Act?
They do. Yeah, it is very similar. And Nick Pope has spoken to this. Of course, Nick Pope worked for the Ministry of Defense investigating UFOs for a few years in the 90s. And he talks about how even though they have a FOIA, it's still very easily to hide the documents. They could have been destroyed. They could have been moved somewhere where nobody knows where they are. Or they could be moved to a private corporation. in which those people do not fall under the Freedom of Information Act, theirs nor ours here in the United States, so they would have no obligation to share those files. So there are a number of scenarios and ways that those files could be kind of swept under the rug. And so, you know, he feels that there are other files out there that may never come to light.
Yeah, well, not to go completely conspiratorial, but, you know, the government, I'm sure, does things through private contractors in order to avoid any type of congressional, I'm talking about our government, congressional investigations or that could be possible.
Well, it seems that the military at times, and I'm sure other agencies, will destroy files if they're that, you know, incendiary. I don't know if I'm saying if they're that, you know, revealing of crimes or something really negative to which they feel they never should come to light. And maybe they feel that there's no value to the information anymore anyway. I think people do destroy documents probably on a regular basis. I think we've heard of that several times. So some of these documents could be destroyed. In fact, my next show will be with Nick Redfern, and we actually already did the interview, and he and I talked quite a bit about this when we talked about Roswell. We'll both be speaking out there, and he has some of your listeners may know, and maybe you'll need to talk to him at some point about it too. He has a alternative theory when it comes to Roswell. And it's, you know, like those are files that they say they've lost. They've been destroyed and they're gone. So,
yeah. But Chase Brandon found a box that said Roswell on it.
Yeah, but I mean, this is the whole problem with the Chase Brandon thing. He found a box in the CIA's library. And apparently... and this is a library any CIA agent can go into in Langley. It's right there, I guess, in the lobby. You do have to be a CIA employee to go in there. But this box, it apparently just had books. And in particular, it was Corso's book he read. So it doesn't seem like it had anything secret or just it just had, you know, like books and media stuff, nothing that the public could didn't see. Although it is interesting that Chase Brandon says the material, including, you know, the Day After Roswell book, convinced him that, you know, there was something to the Roswell incident. But it doesn't sound as though he necessarily read anything that was top secret. And if he did, I mean, that wouldn't be the best place to have it, where any CIA agent can go in there and say, oh, look at this. Aliens are real.
Not only that, I'm sure that anybody would realize the fact that if there was a file box with Roswell material in it, it's not going to say Roswell on the outside. It would say box number C2357 or some type of code numbers or something. It wouldn't.
Well, in a library, it might say Roswell.
Yeah, I didn't know it was in a library, actually.
Yeah, if it was official. You know, documentation, you're right. I think it would say box XYZ or box 12345-753, you know. But since it's a library, it makes more sense even that it is less sensitive material, because it's just, you know, they have it in their Roswell section. They have sections for probably everything. Maybe even a Martin Willis section.
Well, it's similar to I had mentioned on the show months ago, that, you know, an ex-CIA agent, not a former, a retired CIA agent, had, you know, Magic 12 documents in his footlocker, which I thought was, you know, meant something, but it could be just a curiosity thing. You know, I never did get anywhere with his son or anything on that. So I think it's just something out of curiosity that someone may have in the topic itself, and just, you know, collect that, as it's probably fun for them to read through something like that.
I agree with you 100%, my friend.
Yeah.
So we're kind of going long, but we have the big story you plugged at the beginning of my section here. So you want me to go over the Kurt Russell thing?
Go long. Go long.
All right. And I love this story because, yeah, it's Kurt Russell says he witnessed the Phoenix Lights, the famous, maybe the most famous or at least the most seen UFO event here in the United States. So Guardians of the Galaxy 2 just came out. I just saw it this weekend. It's excellent. I loved it. And Kurt Russell's in it, and he is great. So they are doing this interview for BBC One's The One Show in the UK. And it's Chris Pratt and Kurt Russell. And the host opens up this folder that says top secret. And he says, I've gone through the international files to find an interesting story for you guys. And I didn't see the whole thing, but I have seen some of it. And apparently they talked about how he found a UFO story, and Chris Pratt said he doesn't really believe in UFOs or something. And so he started to read this UFO story, the host. And he says, you know, guys may be interested that in March of night, or no, he didn't even say a date. He just said that in Phoenix, Arizona, there was a pilot that was coming in for a landing. He was flying with his son, and he saw six lights in the sky and these UFOs. And upon landing, he reported these UFOs. The control tower said they didn't catch anything on radar. So the host says mystery. Trying to bring some excitement to things. And Kurt Russell says, yeah, the plane number to that plane was Bravo 2 Tango Sierra. And I know this because I was the pilot of that plane. To which the host go, oh, my gosh. And Chris Pratt makes this funny face kind of like, what? And so Chris Pratt didn't seem to be in the loop on this whole thing. So Kurt Russell says, yeah, I was bringing my son, Oliver, who is actually Goldie Hawn's son. And he's not married to Goldie Hawn. So it's not even really his stepson. But I guess Oliver considers Kurt Russell his dad because he grew up with him and everything. So he calls him his son. And Oliver Hudson, so Kate Hudson's brother. So he's an actor as well. So he was flying his son to Phoenix to drop him off so he could see his girlfriend. And as they were flying in, they see these six lights. Oliver says, hey, Dad, what's that? You know, should we call this in or are we okay? And Kurt Russell said, I don't know what that is. So he calls into the tower and says, hey, we're coming in for a landing and we see these lights. Should we be concerned? And they said, well, we're not catching anything on radar. So he says, okay. They land. He does report it as a UFO because he says, you know, he didn't know what they were, so he determined it was unidentified. So he does report it. But they land. He drops off his son. He flies back to L.A. That's it. He nor his son talk about it at all after that. Then one day, and he doesn't say when. I'm guessing this is recent because he hasn't shared this story before. But he says Goldie Hawn was watching a TV show about UFOs, and they were talking about the Phoenix Lights, this big incident, of course, on March 13th, 1997. And they say that there was a general aviation pilot who was flying with his son who reported seeing the lights. And that just triggered something. He said he felt like Richard Dreyfuss. So when he was watching the show, he felt like, I know something about this, but I don't know why I know something about this. Why does this sound familiar? And when they talked about the pilot, he said it just clicked and he said, hey, I think that was me. So he went to his flight logs to see. And sure enough, the flight was on the same time as the Phoenix Lights. So he says, yeah, I saw the Phoenix Lights. It was unidentified. And what's funny is he says, what he feels is the weirdest thing about this whole event is that if he wouldn't have seen the show, he would have never thought about it. He said, you know, for some reason it went out of his head that they had seen this UFO and reported it, and he hadn't thought anything about it until he saw the show.
Isn't that something? I've heard so many times where people have said something similar to that. Where a sighting just, they forgot all about it until something jagged their memory.
Yeah, they see something really weird, And they just ignore it. They're like, wow, that's really weird. What the hell is that?
Yeah.
And then they go on with their lives and don't think twice about it.
Now, a listener, and of course I want to thank you out there, listener, whoever you were, that sent me that video, I think it was a few weeks ago, but I watched it like, it was one of those things where I watched like really late at night or in the middle of the night when I couldn't sleep or something, and I forgot all about that until you brought it up the other day. Yeah, this is great. Kurt Russell's, I don't know, I really always liked him a lot. He's a cool actor. He seems like a really nice guy, even though you don't know him in person, but just the interviews and things I've seen, he just seems like a real down-to-earth type.
He does. He seems really cool. And I love the story because, you know, I'm really close with my girlfriend's daughters, especially the youngest who's graduating tomorrow from high school. Mm-hmm. And so I understand. I feel similar. And, you know, it's really cool. And it speaks to Kurt Russell that, you know, that I guess Kate and Oliver Hudson regard him as their father, even though he isn't, just because he's been there for them.
Right.
To help raise them and everything. So, and even though he and Goldie, after all of these years, have never gotten married. So it's really cool. And he is he seems like a cool guy and a great actor. I've always loved him too. And he is really good in Guardians of the Galaxy too. Great movie if you haven't seen it. I loved it. And I would say I liked the first one, but I think I like this one a little more actually.
Really? Wow. You know, that's so unusual to like the second, you know, the second in a series.
I know.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. And it is unusual. But, of course, even though it's unusual, it's wonderful when that happens.
Right. Hey, did you ever, this is totally off subject, but have you ever watched the movie Overboard with them two in it, with Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell? That is so funny. That's
yes,
such a great
it
movie.
It is really funny. I mean, one of the lines from that really sticks in my head, and I just think it's so hilarious for some stupid reason because it's a stupid scene. It's when the little kid, like Goldie Hawn, they drive her nuts, and you know, Kurt Russell comes home, and she's like catatonic, and the little kid goes, I like it when she goes, bah, 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 bah.
I totally remember that because I've watched that movie so many times. That's really funny. Yeah, you get that down pretty good.
Yeah, really funny.
Yeah, awesome. All right, well, I know we went extra long, 20-some-odd minutes.
Whoa.
6 minutes, almost a half hour. But you know what? I'm cool with that. So
good.
You have a good one, and I'll be talking to you next week.
All right, you have a great one, too. Talk to you next week.
All right, everyone, hang on for just 1 minute after this quick music break, and you'll hear the phone ringing. I'm going to be calling Don Ledger. Hey,
Yo.
Don, welcome to the show. This is Martin Willis. How are you?
How you doing, Mark?
Good. Welcome. You were on my show, God, I think it was back in 2012, maybe. And
I think it was.
Now, there's a lot of talk about Shag Harbor lately, just because it's coming up, you know, mostly because it's coming up on the 50th anniversary.
50th.
And if you could, can you, for the person, there was someone in our chat room. Now, I do have a bunch of questions for you that came in last week. And so I'm going to be asking you a bunch of questions. But if you can give like a, you know, like a 10 or 15 minute nutshell of how the whole thing happened and how you got involved in it actually as well, I'd like to know that. You don't live real far away from there, or do you? Do you live far away?
Oh, a three-hour car drive.
Yeah, 3 hours, okay. That's probably not really that far for up there, right? Yeah.
No.
So if you can give kind of a nutshell of how of what transpired back on October 4th, 1967, and then, you know, further on, like I said, we have a couple of questions that branch out of there as well that'll be coming up. But just if you go ahead and talk about that, I'd be grateful.
Yeah, Martin, where are you at physically? Where's the show
I'm in the state of Maine.
Oh, you're in Maine. Well, you're across from us, not south of us. You know Maine goes further north than Nova Scotia does, do you?
No, I didn't realize that.
True.
I think I have to do a lot it of is. Driving. I plan on getting to Shag Harbor with the conference this year. And I think I've got a long, long drive. I haven't mapped it out yet, but I think I'll be on.
There's a ferry goes across, but it's pretty expensive.
Well, someone told me the ferry doesn't run anymore, but I'll check into that.
I think it is this year.
Oh, okay.
Again,
well,
who knows?
All right. Yeah. So let's hear about what happened back in 1967.
Yeah. You want to go into
sure,
that?
Sure. Yeah. Why not? Yeah.
Martin? Yeah. Okay. Excuse me. And I seem to have a lot of throat clearing going on here tonight. October 4th, 1967. And there was a portion of that night where there was quite a few UFO reports, and all over the southwestern part of Nova Scotia. If you look at your map there, it sort of looks like the tail end of a lobster, and without the fins. And if you sort of take that back end, that area down there was maybe as many as 30 UFO sightings by different people. Nothing spectacular, you know. Usually nocturnal lights in the sky and so on, but. Around 11:30 that night, that's when Laurie Wickens and Dave Kendrick Laurie Wickens and his friends were coming back from Cape Sable Island at a dance over there. That's a little island that's got a causeway going out to it. It's about 13 miles to the northeast. When they were in their car and they noticed a string of lights in the sky on the right-hand side of the car sort of traveling along with them, but passing. And they figured it was up about 1,000 feet or so. And finally, as they were getting closer to Shag Harbor, the thing started to curl around the front and made a beeline towards the water in the harbor, towards just past the western side of the harbor. Now, they just had barely caught up with it, and when it went behind a line of trees, and they came around a bend over a little hill there. You'd see it yourself when you get down there, and it opens up right onto the water there. You're right on the edge of the Atlantic Ocean. So what used to be called the Irish moss plant. And he's lost sight of it, but one of the girls in the car thought she heard a whoosh and a bang. Anyway, they pulled over in the gravel parking lot right on the water, on the edge of the water, and they looked out, and they could see this dark object, hence the title of the book, and with a pale yellow light drifting on the water or under its own power, sort of going away from the shore. At that point, it was only about 800 feet out, which wasn't very far. So they were a bit frightened, a little puzzled by this. Laurie and a male friend of his thought that maybe this was a crashed airplane drifting on the water. So they got it back in the car. Not, of course, we're in 1967, of course, no cell phones or anything like that. They went a little further down the road towards Woods Harbor, which is only maybe a mile away, and stopped at a gas station down there where there was a payphone, and they called the RCMP back in Barrington Passage, which is on going way back up through Shag Harbor again, way up to the northeast, well, at least another 15 miles anyway, and into Barrington Passage, and got a hold of the detachment there, the RCMP, Royal Canadian Mounted Police Detachment, and got a hold of Corporal Victor Rubicki. Told him what they thought had happened, or at least Laurie did anyway. Laurie's about 17 going on 18 at this time. And Werbicki said to him, he knew him, have you been drinking? And Laurie said, no. He was kind of ticked off about that. Well, I've been drinking. He says, you know, I think an airplane's crashed out there. So Werbicki's phone started to ring, and he said, look, give me the phone number there, and I'll get back to you. He says, my phone's ringing. So when he answered his phone, he had about four or five more calls from people saying they thought they saw, it looked like a lighter, an airplane lighter, and it went down towards the water. It looked like it crashed in Shag Harbor. And after about the third call after that, he was really taking this seriously. He got back to Laurie and told him to get back in the car and go back up the Irish Moss plant and keep an eye on this thing until they could get there. So in the meantime, another couple of young fellows there were also coming back from the same dance, and Norm Smith and Dave Kendrick. If you have my book, Maritime UFO Files, there's a picture on the front, and that's Dave Kendrick. Now, Dave was driving the car, and his friend Norm, he was on the right-hand side, and they saw basically the same thing, but a little, maybe a hair after or just before. It's uncertain. And but they didn't go any further than Norm Smith's place, which was just in at the edge of Shag Harbor on the opposite side from where the object went in. And Dave Kendrick drove home, told his mother about it, and then went to bed. And that was the end of his participation at that during that evening. Norm Smith told his father about it, and his uncle lived on the other end of the of this duplex-type house that was there. And he went outside to show it to him, and they saw the police cars going down, two Mountie cars going down, heading in towards the direction of where the object might have gone down. So they figured something was up. They go down and give a hand. Now, I'm pre-seasoning here. You know, this is really trimming
sure,
it down
yeah.
for you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they ended up getting down there. And when they got there, the Mounties were there. There were three Mountie cars. Probably about, all told, maybe 18 to 24 people. Seems to be the best estimate I could get over the years. Standing around watching this thing out on the water. The Mounties were watching it. Laurie Wickens and his crew were there. Norm Smith, of course, was there with his uncle. And they saw this thing drifting out on the water, still either under its own speed or drifting with the tide. The tide was ebbing. And so now, October night was cool, but it was a clear night and no moon. So the Corporal Werbicki decided he wanted to get a search party together. They considered taking a dory out that was tied up alongside of the Irish Moss plant, but that's a boat.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the fishermen around here used to carry them in on their larger motor-driven fishing boats as a safety item, or just to go out and do work off the side. But anyway, then they figured, well, there was a bit of a lop on. Maybe they'd it was a little too dangerous. So Werbicki decided he was going to go to a house just a way up the road and call some of the fishermen that he knew, see if he could get one of them to take their boat out, and they'd go out and see if they could help out. Just as he was about to leave, the object seemed to sink. It looked like it sank. And what they had seen out there was this dark, lens-shaped object sort of either sitting on the water or slightly above it, with the pale yellow light on it, just glowing. Everybody there said, all the fishermen involved said, no, there wasn't any buoy or any kind of a lighthouse or anything out there that would give that effect. They know the water like the back of their hand there. So Werbicki had the two O'Briens there, or the two Brines, two Rons, I should say, Ron O'Brien and Ron Pond. Ron Pond was the rookie. He was left there to take down testimony from the other people. And Ron O'Brien, and who had been also sent off to another house to make a call to the Rescue Coordination Center in Halifax to see if there's, you know, if they'd had an airplane crash or anything, or any aircraft were missing. So anyway, those two eventually ended up going back up along with some of the people from the site, and they went to joined up with two fishermen that Werbicki had scared up down at the government wharf in Shag Harbor. And they got on the boats, went out to the western approach to where this thing might be. And they crossed the water. It went about a mile of water to cross between the western approach and Oder Island, or Bon Pitage Island, and trying to find this thing, which, of course, had already submerged, apparently. on their way, they ran across a slick of a yellow covered foam. It looked like shaving cream about 4 inches thick. Now, the people in the area and most people that live around the ocean around here in Nova Scotia know what sea foam is. You see it all the time when you're at the edge of the waters. But everybody said, no, this wasn't anything like sea foam. It looked more like shaving cream or whipped cream sitting on the water. It was about 4 inches thick and very even. And there was about, you know, a half a mile of it strung out going down down this swath where the UFO had been. And it was about 80 feet wide, just going by the lengths of the boats. I mean, it was about two boat lengths wide. So they cruised around in this stuff. They didn't like the idea of being in there and just in the general area looking for survivors, because they really did think it was an airplane crash. They thought the foam might have come from some kind of mixture of gasoline and salt water. They didn't know what it was. In the meantime, Coast Guard had been called over in Clark's Harbor over in Cape Sable Island. And they sent a boat over. It took about an hour to get there because it was 13 miles away and it only did about 10 or 11 knots. And when they showed up, they asked to talk to Ron O'Brien, who was the on-scene commander now. And they told him, because he's the one that called the Coast Guard in the first place over up in Halifax. And they said that there was nothing missing. There was no planes missing from up and down the coast, down in the east coast of the United States or in Nova Scotia or up the east coast of Canada. Nothing was missing. So they were wondering then, what are they looking for? They searched through the night right up till some of them 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning, and the first two boats out, they decided they better get some sleep because they hadn't slept since 3 o'clock the morning before. And it was pretty late now, but by this time there was about 6 fishing boats out there helping out, plus the Coast Guard cutter, as they called it, lifeboat, with Ronnie Newell as the skipper on that, and they continued to search. And the search carried on for, you know, the next day anyway, as they cruised back and forth. By Friday, because when this thing happened, it was happening at 25 after 11 in the evening on the 4th, and we quickly went into the 5th on the 6th on a Friday. The Navy, by this time, had sent down some divers via helicopter and a deuce and a half, which was, you know, a military vehicle on all their equipment and so on, got on some of the boats there, and they went out and they dove in the water starting around 1 o'clock in the afternoon and went to about 6 that night. They came out of the water, said they couldn't find anything. Water there is only about 80 feet deep and pretty clear. And wondered, and then again, still, well, what's going on here? What were we looking at, you know? And they didn't know. Nobody could say, nobody could tell them what had happened. And, of course, as we know, it went on a little further after that. But there's no secret about this portion of the action, if you want to call it that, of the event, because it was in the newspapers. The Chronicle Herald was a huge newspaper in eastern Canada, probably still is, but it's not as big as newspapers used to be back in their day. And it had, you know, 2-inch banner red headlines saying, you know, maybe something, UFO crash in Shag Harbor, RCAF, Royal Canadian Air Force at the time. Mm-hmm. So, not much happened after that. The rest of the story didn't develop until maybe almost 20-some years later when Chris Stiles stumbled upon a guy who had a story to tell. And by that time, I was involved or got involved shortly after with Chris. And we started to look further into this case. So the rest you know if you read the book.
Yeah. So I'll ask you some questions along the way here. First of all, did anyone take samples of that yellow foam at all?
No. And, well, nobody had any reason to at the time. But there is a letter, one of the letters that said it's a shame somebody, a margin note, I believe it was, saying it was a shame somebody didn't think to take to throw a bucket over the side and take a sample. But Norm Smith, if I recall, was supposed to have put his arms over the side and tried to lift some of the stuff out of the water, but wouldn't come up. His arms came up wet. Ron O'Brien told me later on that whoever, he didn't know the name of the fisherman at the time, because there's maybe 6 or 7 on each boat, young fellas. He said he rubbed his arm and looked at his arm to see what was on there, but it just looked like it was wet. there didn't seem to be any odor or anything to it, although in general there was an odor on the water of sort of like sulfur, a sulfury smell.
Wow. Yeah, well, that would kind of make sense with the yellow. And do you think that when it landed, like I heard you say, around 800 feet out, do you think that it quickly soared? We'll talk about it later where it goes up to toward Government Point up there. But do you think it right away kind of moved away sort of toward that direction or somewhere?
Well, in order for it to get away from Shag Harbor and between Oder Island and Shag Harbor, if you look, because you're almost on the shoulder of Nova Scotia, which is turning around to go into the Gulf of Maine there. And it would have had to get out of that area and then make a bend to the left and go up the coast to get up to Shelburne. Like I said, you know, it's, by the time the Mounties were there and everybody was standing there and the thing went underwater, it was a considerably further distance out on the water than when Laurie Wickens and his friends first saw it land on the water. And although people at the time thought it was a crash, it seems to be more apparent, at least to me anyway, that this was some kind of a controlled landing into the water for whatever reason.
Right. Now, what part of this whole event did it change from a possible airplane crash to UFO?
Well, you know, the Air Force, the Air Desk in Ottawa, that was Squadron Leader Baines, had taken the first call on this thing and lined up the Rescue Coordination Center in Halifax and the Assets and Maritime Command, you know, the Navy, the whole nine yards, and got them all put together. It was actually the Air Force document that has UFO underlined, 1, 2, 3 underneath, marked on the document, and Squadron Leader's name is above it. And then they started calling it the dark object, and then there was a UFO in one of the documents. So nobody in the area would have thought, probably even thought to call it a UFO. I don't even think they'd really experienced much in that area before Shag Harbor. You know, they might have heard about it on TV or something the odd time, but it's not the kind of thing they'd sort of, you know, get involved with or know anything about. Maybe ghost stories down in that area, but not so much about UFOs.
Right.
So if it went to UFO, it went because the media made it that way. But first of all, it was the Air Force that brought up the idea of a UFO. But again, it was an unidentified flying object, so it's not like they're making out anything to be an alien object. Although this thing certainly has all the stink on it for an alien object, but. There you go. That's what I have for you right now. I have my own personal ideas for later on, maybe, but I haven't fully developed them yet.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I know it kind of gives UFO a bad name. And that's why a lot of people are using UAP, because people automatically think, oh, you know, you're calling it an alien, but really the term UFO just means unidentified flying object. And that's really all it does mean.
Yeah.
And I remember Kucinich, however you say his name, you know, took a lot of grief. And he said, well, it was an unidentified flying object. That was during the 2008 campaign here in the States, a politician. So one of the things I thought of is what kind of myths are out there that you would like to squash? In other words, are there some stories out there that are untrue that are told about Shag Harbor?
Such as?
I just wondered if you have heard things over the years that you think that you know that aren't true that people have. And the reason I'm bringing this up because that happens with big cases like Roswell or Phoenix Lights. You know, there's always some side stories that are not, you know, not accurate at all that kind of get spread by, say, tabloids or something.
Yeah.
Is there anything like that with Shag Harbor?
I don't ever actually recall seeing anything where it was outrageously off the mark. I mean, there's been some conjecture around, you know, the very first off the cuff remarks by some of the people, oh, it was some fishermen shooting around flares, which was nonsense, of course, you know. And one of the other ones, what it was, some kind of a sonar buoy or something, that came up at one of the conferences we had down. Well, it was actually more like a talk we gave down in Shea Harbor years ago at the elementary school that's right next to the water where this occurred. And, I had a gymnasium, big gymnasium, and there were about 300 people there, I guess. And this one guy jumped up and said, you know, he said he'd found a sonar buoy on the shore. And he thought that's what they'd seen floating in the water. Well, you know, strangely enough, when I was a kid around 13 years old, we used to go down to the dump. There was a junkyard, Zatzman's Junkyard, where we used to be able to go down there and pick up all kinds of odds and ends. Oh, you had to pay for them. But what they did have was, because Halifax is a military, you know, naval base, Air Force base and everything else here, they used to drop sonar buoys when they were practicing or even tracking subs in the out on in the Atlantic. And the used ones or some of the old motor ones, they just get rid of them. And we could buy them for 75 cents. I had four or five of them at the time. These things were about 3 feet long, maybe about 8 inches in diameter, with a little tiny little amber yellow light on it that was not meant to be seen over a great distance. It was meant to be seen from, you know, from the aircraft that dropped it, just to keep track of the thing. And then after a while, the certain little plugs would dissolve and the thing would sink to the bottom after its usefulness was over. But, I mean, there's no way anybody would mistake this, and, you know, 18 to 24 people would stand around, including three mounties, and look out at this tiny little light they couldn't even see from, you know, probably more than 100 feet away, and claim that that was some kind of an anomaly, you know. And certainly it wasn't what the people, you know, the witnesses saw coming down out of the sky, which was three and four and five sequentially flashing lights in a line. That's probably the one that annoyed me more than anything, but I've never really heard anybody come up with any kind of an off the wall story about what actually happened in Shag Harbor. You're going to get the usual thing. Well, you know what it was? It was probably a secret military aircraft. That's the other one. Well, I've been a pilot for 34 years, but I've been I'm an aviation writer. I'm a journalist. I write about aviation, and I've been doing that for 10 years solid now. I was like doing a regular column for 10 years. For a Canadian magazine, that's aviation, and dealing all of that, you know, all kinds of different aircraft, types of aircraft. I know what's up there flying, and we didn't have it in the Second World War. We didn't have it after the Second World War was over with Kenneth Arnold and you know, Roswell and some of these other places. And we had some. Now we have some stealth aircraft, but I mean, we know what they are. There's only 19 of those stealth bombers. Two of them already crashed, and the old stealth fighter, well, that's a joke anyway. Those things weren't even supersonic, for God's sakes. But, I mean, those kind of explanations is giving us they're secret military aircraft. That's what they are. Well, I mean, they thought that's what they were back at the end of the Second World War. They thought that's what it was during the war in the First World or the Second World War. Nothing that was ever able to be proved, you know. And there just wasn't anything around that could match what these things could do or the size of them in some cases. You know, even during the Second World War, some of these objects were recorded as being 800 or 1,000 feet long, or one was a half mile and in length, you know. But fortunately with the Shag Harbor incident, I haven't seen very much. I don't think I've seen anything where they've actually tried to make up another story surrounding it, you know, saying this is what happened, you know, and a bunch of, you know, space, as they call them nowadays, space aliens, crawling around the area, even though there was allusion to it, but by, you know, some of the witnesses on the other end of this thing up at Government Point.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I want to talk about that in a little bit. Going back to the yellow foam one more time, did that make a, before it dissipated, was that kind of almost like a strip? Like, could that possibly have been a trail of the direction that the, say, if it was a USO underwater moving, could that have been a trail that could have left?
Well, that's conjecture yeah. now, but probably a pretty good one. It's associated with because nobody knew what it was, and nobody knew what the other thing was. You sort of put the two unknowns together and come up with one big unknown, and that is pretty much the thinking. You know, that whatever this was, it was a byproduct of what, you know, this object that had gone onto the water and then went under the water. And I can't refute it, considering the fishermen that I talked to that were involved. Well, you know, Norm Smith and, for one, I'm trying to think of one of the other guys I talked to. They also saw they saw it when they went out there, but they didn't know what to make of it. They said, you know, just definitely was not sea foam, you know, which is patchy to begin with. And it was about a half mile long by about 80 feet wide, a strip of it. And 80 feet is not much longer than 60 feet wide, you know, and maybe, you know, just spread out a bit or whatever. Who knows? I can't say for sure that it came from this thing, but, you know, it sort of has, you know, all the earmarks of maybe being some kind of byproduct or whatever this thing was or whatever it was doing. But whatever it was, it didn't seem to harm anybody. It didn't dissipate it, as you mentioned, and that was the end of it. It was unfortunately somebody didn't try to take a sample of it and, you know, seal it off and then maybe have it examined later. They might have found something in
okay,
that.
What about, you know, some people, well, I don't even know if they had Chinese lanterns at the time, but you mentioned that someone mentioned flares. Is that an ongoing thing that people are actually saying it was? Or is that just...
No, somebody mentioned it at the time, and then one of the reports said that it might have been some fishermen shooting some flares off. Yeah. And it just doesn't make any sense. Yeah. When they rode on the water, the only light was a pale yellow light on the object. As for them driving along Highway Number 3 inland, who was shooting flares inland? And yeah. just, you know, I'm familiar with flares. You know, I've been around those things all my life, you know. Part of my family were fishermen to begin with, you know, particularly when I was younger. For one thing, if they had them, they used them on the boat. They weren't just, and this is a weak one, but I mean, they weren't just going to fire these things off for the sake of firing them off because they had to pay money for
right.
them. But they're just, a flare goes up, arcs over, comes back down, burns out on its way down. That's pretty much what it does, and they're red, you know, and there's just no relationship to what the witness has said. And we often find that in ufology, you know, I hate that word, but there you go, people try to, I watched one of those programs on National Geographic the other night, UFOs Declassified, and they had an astronomer from Toronto, York University, I think it was, on there talking about, you know, what he thought people were seeing. Well, he had no conception of what the reports say, or, you know, what we've delved into over the years. And I'm not talking about Shea Garber. I'm just talking in general. That, you know, they started talking about Venus and Saturn, you know, and Jupiter and the moon and all this. It's just plain foolishness, you know. They just don't match into what the witness is saying.
Yes.
And you see that quite often. And it's quite annoying, actually.
Yep.
And these people are taken as experts when they're really not in that area.
I have talked about that a number of times in the show where, you know, the story that, you know, the explanation that has been produced is so far off from, and there was another, Jordan Bonaparte talked about this other major case, and it was a 1970s. Where someone said it was Venus or something, and it has, you know, how could Venus move and turn and have flashing lights, and, you know, it's just so far off. It's kind of...
Well, they had tried to attribute autokinesis to that. You know, the eyeballs, when it's fixed on in the night sky and on a point of light, that your eyeball actually twitches around, but that's not what these things are doing, you know.
Well, now, was at the time of Shag Harbor, was there any type of a UFO flap in that area at all?
Well, that's the one I was talking about that night, yeah.
But I mean, I mean, you know, before and after, was there other UFOs seen before and after that night?
Yeah, but not, I wouldn't say as a flap. You know, flaps are pretty intense. They go on for, you know, a month or 2 months, maybe a whole year. And we've had them in this area, but but they seem to run generally anyway. And just in, say, in North America, you'd see, you know, a flap, and then there might be one over around Europe, you know. It's strange to think that one of the things we had to contend with years ago was after the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind came out. Years after that, the naysayers would say, well, you know what that was all about, all these UFOs that people are seeing. They saw the movie, and now everybody's seeing UFOs. But in fact, that was not true. The reports of unidentified flying objects went down after the movie came out. And you know what? More people were going to probably be outside looking at the sky than they were before, but yet they saw less UFOs in that general time frame than they had before. So
there
you go.
Yeah. There goes that one. Here's a question that came into our forum. Do you think Sag Harbor incident was an actual crash, or that the object instead landed gently on the water and then intentionally submerged?
I think it landed gently on the water and intentionally submerged. I don't know why it did it so dramatically by coming down the highway as it did, but maybe it was making an approach. I don't know. I mean, we all do it with aircraft. Uh-huh. When we're landing, you don't just come in and land. You make an approach. And, you know, but and there's evidence right now anyway to say that the thing landed gently on the water. One of the witnesses has since passed away. But he told his daughter on his deathbed when he was 91 years old, he was dying of brain cancer or something. That was in 1991. He was dying of brain cancer. But he'd alluded to it years before, and then he came back years later when he was dying to say that this thing was what he saw. He went into a little more detail, and he actually had pulled up alongside the Irish moss plant, and he saw two moons. And he thought, now that's odd. Where'd the other moon come from? We got outside to have a look, and then one moon departed, you know, from the side of the other one and went down, gently landed on the water beside him. And that was at the Irish moss plant. And then all of a sudden the car comes pulling into the lot, and he got nervous then because he was involved in a tryst with a woman down in the Woods Harbor, and he was married with a woman that was further away the other direction. So he didn't want anybody to know he's in that area. And at the same time, I had been told by one of my friends down there, I'm trying to remember his first name. His last name is Shan. Doug, sorry. His father had been one of the, or his uncle, I should say, had been one of the fishermen who were the first two fishermen out. Bradford Shand, his name was. And he told me that he'd contacted me by phone, said he had a fisherman friend down there who had actually seen the thing himself that night, but he was with a young lady friend, and he didn't want to mention anything about it, mentioned to anybody, or, you know, for it to really get out, because he didn't want her to be embarrassed. They were only, like, teenagers, you know, 17, 18, maybe, 19. So I said, oh, that's nice to know. So anyway, again, back at that same little school I was telling you about where we had the show that night, or the conference, it was me and Chris talking about Sag Harbor. I brought this up about this fellow having had a this was with this girl when they saw this thing land on the water, and I said it was he didn't want to mention anything because he didn't want to embarrass her. And this woman stands up in the audience and said, well, that was me. So she outed herself right then and there, and so I interviewed her, and we got her name and everything. And she said, we were parked in the car at the end, the other end of the Irish moss plant where the other cars came in, between there and a dirt bank that's there that's quite high. It's probably about 20 feet high there. And we were in there, you know, in the car, and all of a sudden, this thing, light came around from behind, and we lost sight of it, and then it came down and landed on the water right out in front of us. And she said it was very frightening. And, of course, she said we were, you know, we won.
Yeah.
Were you there?
Yeah. I don't know. I heard it blank out for a sec. No, I can hear you. Yeah.
Yeah, same here. Okay. And they had to wait and go to until the sort of the busyness died down at the other end of the Irish moss plant, which is only about 40 feet square, I should say, and about two stories high. And then they sort of snuck out and joined the crowd after that, but they didn't want anybody to know what they were up to while they were at the other end of the building there when everybody else showed up. So at the same time, there was probably Mr. Nickerson. That's just, I don't have his first name right now. It's in the book, actually. If you read the book, Dark Objects, his name is in there. Was sitting on the opposite side of the road. These other two were at the other end of the Irish moss plant, probably no more than 150 feet away from them, in the car, and they saw the thing come down and land on the water. As for the two lights in the sky, I already mentioned that there was no moon that night. The moon set at 5:30 that evening, and this was 11:30 or so, almost 11:30. So he didn't see two moons. He saw two unidentifieds up there, and he didn't know what they were. But that's pretty much borne out by some of the other information that was going on over in Bay of Fundy, which is across the province, maybe 70 miles or so. And by other fishermen who were herring seiners out on the Bay of Fundy, and an RCMP officer with three game wardens that were over in a clearing in South Maitland, and people listening to fishermen on the marine radio at their cottage down in or in their home down in Wedgeport, which is if you look at the southwest coast of Nova Scotia, you'll see a long thin arm sort of sticking down along the edge of the province, and that's called Digby Neck. And right at the end of that, there's a little village down there called Wedgeport, and it's a fishing village. And they were sitting out there that night. They could hear people talking on the marine radio, and they were all abuzz about this object that was buzzing their fishing boat out on the water in Bay of Fundy. So there's a bit of a story in there, too, which is in the book. It's all in there. So and this thing ties in with the same object that the other Mountie and the three game wardens saw over South Maitland, which is over on the other side of the province. And which the game warden the next morning had determined was the direction it was going that night when he checked the local map seemed to be heading over towards the Shag Harbor. He said, not even realizing that anything had happened in Shag Harbor. But the Mountie had come over to see him that morning, told him that, well, that's strange because there was an incident over in Shag Harbor because he was a Mountie and they got the information through their network, I guess. But, I mean, there was all up and down the coast there was incidents. There was the flight. I don't want to tie you up here with this, but, you know, there was Flight 305. That one, I think, was actually a known. I think we pretty much solved that one. Air Canada Flight 305 saw something that night at around 7 o'clock in the evening. But that's almost 4 hours before. Actually, it was probably 8 o'clock our time, 7 o'clock Eastern, your time. Mm-hmm. Up over in the New Brunswick or maybe south of there over Millinocket down in Maine. Well, you know where that is. And, in some of them we call it the Night of the UFOs in the books. And there was, I think, probably 7 or 8 or 9 cases in there that we included.
Oh, I had no idea about that part. Another question that came into our forum, would you say that eyewitness accounts of Shag Harbor incident include reliable corroborating testimony?
Yeah, I would say. I mean, three of them were the RCMP officers. I interviewed them myself. Chris interviewed them. And they pretty much all had the same story. Mind you, by the time we got to them, they were two of them were retired. The other one was, well, actually, I think all three were at that point. The Mountie that was over in South Maitland that night, he was still working. I contacted him. It took me about 2 weeks to track the guy down. You talk to the Mounties and you know, want to talk to a particular Mountie, and they get sort of defensive, mm-hmm. saying, we don't just give out their names and so on. I tracked them down through a friend of mine out in Saskatchewan who also had an uncle who was involved in the RCMP's annual newsletter, and it had the different people who were retired and so on and so forth. And we was able to track them down there, and then I tracked them down from there down to Nova Scotia and then over to to his new job, and which was at the Halifax International Airport, working security at Halifax International. Of course, this was like, what, at that time, probably 25 years later.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know I heard Chris mention that he was, I believe, 12 years old when the incident happened. And that very night, I believe he had some type of sighting that may or may not been related. I'm foggy about that. But did you know that the event happened when it happened?
Did I know it happened when it happened? Yeah. After it happened, yeah. But within a couple of three days, I did. Actually, I was actually in the area myself the night
really?
It happened.
Wow.
But I didn't know I was in the area that night. I did see something weird myself that night, but I didn't have any relationship. Well, it was between Cape Sable Island, Shag Harbor. It's pretty coincidental, actually. But Chris did have a sighting that night, but it was in Halifax or Dartmouth across the harbor, the town of city of Dartmouth across the harbor. And he was 12 years old. It mixes it up on the back of the book when you see it in there. It says, he who himself was a... I'd have to get the book down to get it exact, but says it was a witness to the object. He wasn't a witness. His grandfather was in the area that night and had contact him about it, but Chris had his own event happen that night down in Halifax Harbor. And there was two other people besides Chris who saw this object, an orange-type ball out on the harbor. Chris was a little closer than that. I don't think he was more than a few hundred feet from it. But, I mean, that's a little story, and that's, again, in the book. Uh-huh. And Chris is 10 years younger than me, so I was 22 at the time, and I was a salesman. And on that Wednesday evening, I was traveling down. I used to go late at night so that I wouldn't have to pay for an extra hotel room. I'd leave home and go down and whatever area I was heading to. In this particular time, I was going down to the Yarmouth area and like Shelburne and places like that had little music stores. I used to sell musical instruments and PA systems and that sort of thing. And so I was going down there that night, and it was about 3 o'clock in the morning it would have been Thursday morning now. And to go down, check out Yarmouth and come back up to other little areas like Digby and Kemple and so on up on the opposite shore and make a loop of it. And spend the 2 days doing that. And I pulled over the side of the road, walked to the other side of the road. I pulled off in a little churchyard there. Then I went to the other side of the road very respectfully. It was 3:30 in the morning, and I've been driving for some time. So anyway, while I'm standing there looking across the ditch, I see these red lights zipping around out over Cape Sable and Island. That didn't make any sense. Now, I wasn't a pilot at that point, but I've always been an airplane enthusiast, right? I'm 22 then. I still was an airplane enthusiast. Mm-hmm. Knew a lot about aircraft and so on. And I saw these things out there, and I thought, now what the heck would those be? I'm making a guess, of course, that they're probably some kind of an unidentified flying object. But I can't disassociate that over Cape Sable Island from maybe some kind of or the event itself that was up in Shag Harbor a few hours before that, which I didn't know until I got home. As my wife mentioned to me about the, did you see the headline in the newspaper? And I said, no, what about it? And she said about the UFO someplace down where you were. And she'd forgotten the name. By that time, the newspaper, I arrived home on a Saturday, and I believe the newspaper had already gone out in the garbage or something. If I'd have been smart, I would have gone out and dug it out of there. But as it turns out, I do have the actual newspaper heading. It was clipped off by Ray McLeod himself, who gave it to me. He's the guy that wrote the story. Mm-hmm. And but I didn't realize how close I'd come.
Wow.
And there's a pretty prominent Nova Scotian there. It wouldn't mean anything to Americans, and of course many Canadians wouldn't know anything about it. He ended up being the premier of Nova Scotia 3 years later, 4 years later, 3 years later. And he was coming back from Yarmouth around the old road, highway number 3, around the bottom of the province. It's really helpful to have the map out when I'm talking about this stuff, because it covers a lot of an area down there. And he saw the conglomeration of cars on the side of the road and pulled off and was standing there looking at the thing himself out on the water. So I didn't know this until years later. His son was a pilot, and we became friends over the years, you know, down here, there's not that many of us. And so eventually I ran across it, and he found out he'd written a book about it, and he read it, and he got back to me and said his dad saw the same thing that night with a bunch of other people while they were standing there looking out on the the area is called the Sound. It's right on the mouth of the harbor, Shag Harbor entrance on the western approach there. Mm-hmm. And but so that surprised me. And he's still alive, that guy, but he's in his probably in his 90s now. I don't know whether he'd want to be up to having been a pretty prominent politician if he wanted to. Talk about something like that. And I might give him a shot someday. I don't know if I got off the track there a bit.
That's okay. A question I thought of is, I heard Chris say that it was a number of years later before he, something jogged his memory or something of the event. And then he started, getting involved and researching it thoroughly. And then you later joined him. Had anyone before that go deeply into research this incident before, Chris?
No, not that I know of. Mm. And the thing that jogged his memory was the Socorro incident on Unsolved Mysteries.
Yes.
That would have been about 1992 mm-hmm. to 93. He saw it that night, and it just jogged his memory about the his grandfather having called him, plus his own, his own incident. And and I saw the same episode when it, remember Unsolved Mysteries on years ago?
Oh, yeah, loved it.
It was pretty good. I mean, they eventually had Unsolved Mysteries, which were usually just regular mysteries, but they started getting every once in a while they get a good UFO mystery in there or something, and Socorro's definitely a good one. So up until then, other than interest maybe by the odd reporter who would, National Enquirer, which back in those days was more of a newspaper than whatever they
tabloid.
Call it nowadays, which is basically fake news. Yeah, it's a tabloid. Well, it was a tabloid then, a tabloid-sized newspaper. But it's just gone off the wall now. But, I mean, back then they did some pretty good stuff. And they did a report on it, but and they talked to Dave Kendrick, who really wasn't that deeply involved in the thing. He saw the thing when they were driving down the road, but then he went home after he dropped off Norm Smith and went to bed, told his mother what they'd seen, this weird thing in the sky, and then he went to bed, and that was it for him. But no, not really. And there was the small, what's his first name now? The document, I still have it here somewhere. I've got all the documents. Mentioned about seeing he tried to get some information from the armed forces about he wrote a letter to one of the commanders or one of the naval people or maybe the air desk in Ottawa, and they sent him out what they had, which is basically mentioned that there have been a fisherman saw something out on the water in the sky, and then it went on the water, and they didn't get into any real detail on it. But if he never took it any further than that, maybe a 3-page write-up that he'd done and sent it off to I think he was with APRO back in the day, NICAP or APRO, but I'm pretty sure it was APRO. Mm-hmm. And send it into them, and that was the end of it. And that's, but it survived in their file. So, and I have a copy of it here somewhere. So, mm-hmm. Most of that stuff showed up in the archives up here in the National Archives in Ottawa. And after Chris had viewed the microfilm himself, if it's important to you, him and I had both applied to become MUFON investigators back in the day. Mm-hmm. And we didn't know each other at the time. And they put us together. Chris lived in Dartmouth, and I lived in Dartmouth or Halifax. Time doesn't make any difference. It's, like a twin city thing. And
they alerted each of us independently that the other was was there, and we should, with phone numbers, and we could get together. So we called one another. I forget who called who first, and we had a meeting over in my offices. By that time, I was a director of legislative television, and for the Nova Scotia Legislature, and so we got together in my offices one Saturday and started to hash this thing out, and that was our first meeting. And he brought up Sag Harbor, and then while he was talking about it, that's when I recalled what had happened at the time. I'd forgotten the name of the place, and so anyway, he sort of dragged me into that thing. And then after he got really interested, he said, one day, he said, there's probably a book here. And I said, well, he says, but I'd find somebody who's good with the King's English. And I said, well, I'm a writer. So I said, I could probably give it a shot, see what I could do with it. And that's how that started. Huh. And we started. What I did then was re-interviewed Chris all over again, because he had the information he had, gotten from the archives. I went to the archives. I got the microfilm brought down to the library loaner system, which is what we had back in the 90s, and went through all those microfilm reels, RG-77, 24, and I forget what the other one is. I've got to mark down here somewhere. So, this is, we're going back, 20-odd years now. Memory's not what it used to be. And I went through all the microfilm, and in those days, you'd watch it on a microfilm viewer, and if you wanted to copy anything, you had to be watching it on a particular type of microfilm viewer that also had a copier embedded in it. So then you, for 25 cents, you could copy that particular little frame on the microfilm. Mm-hmm. And I spent about, $200 in quarters. Jeez. And that thing over a period of 3 months down, copying all of these documents. Wow. And, going up there at lunch hours from work, or if I had a break for a half an hour, go up there and look at some more. They kept them for 3 months for me so I could go all through them again. Wow. I sent off copies of them. There's about 500 documents there anyway. Not all about Sag Harbor. This is just UFOs in general. There's quite a few. I wrote another book there called Maritime UFO Files, which is about and by Maritimes, the Maritime provinces are Nova Scotia, Prince Edward Island, and New Brunswick, I should say, at where Stanton Friedman lives, mm-hmm. right? And and Newfoundland, Labrador, but they weren't recognized as the Maritimes for some reason back in the day. They weren't part of Canada until 1949 anyway. So, but anyway, that was the four areas. And there was quite a few American Air Force bases, and there was a lot of good sighting down here. I was actually shocked, because until I really got involved in this, I didn't realize, that UFO incidents occurred in anywhere but the United mm-hmm. States, because every book I read, it was usually about the United States or some place in France, there's an incredible amount of UFO reports up here over the years.
Right, right. So let's talk about what Chris found out 20 years later, and that has to do with the military base up north. I think you said
Cape Breton? Yeah, it wasn't. It was up in just up north of Sag Harbor. There, about 20. It's only about 25 miles away at the most. And that's Shelburne.
That's what I meant. So that's what Chris found out about 20 years later, right?
Yeah. He ran across the guy. It's one of those things where coincidence, if you want to call them coincidence, start to happen. And then in different places, you run into people that all of a sudden, because you mentioned something to them, they say, oh, yeah, I knew something about that because I was slightly involved with that and so mm-hmm. on. And the first one, of course, was the diver, Leo Ganot. I can mention his name now because he passed away several years ago. He was a diver at the remember that fleet I mentioned that the divers came down from Halifax because Halifax is a huge naval mm-hmm. town, always has been. The British were, and then of course our own navy, and then during the Second World War and the First World Wars, it was the makeup place for the convoys, Halifax Harbor. Place blew up in 1917, almost wiped out the north end of Halifax. Mm-hmm. The biggest man-made explosion until they dropped the H-bomb on Hiroshima. But anyway, So the in this particular instance, and here it is, a little bit, another bit of a coincidence as well. Chris knew a fellow whose father was a trainer in the Fleet Diving Unit. They are the divers for the Canadian Navy. They're still there. They moved over from the Halifax side over to the Dartmouth side, but they're still going, as they would anyway. He said, do you suppose you could somehow find out who that maybe the divers were in Shag Harbor? Because he wanted to find out what they'd seen on the bottom in Shag Harbor, if anything. And so his name was Guy Fenn. Guy Fenn Jr. was the fellow that Chris knew, and they were, probably about the same age anyway. And Guy Fenn Sr. was the trainer for the Fleet Diving, Fleet Divers. He was, and we're talking about scuba diving and so on. And Guy Fenn Jr. asked his father, Guy Fenn Sr., if he could maybe find out who the divers were on that dive down in Shag Harbor. So Guy Fenn Sr. came back with a list of divers, and one of them was Leo Gonneau. First one that Chris attempted to talk to turned out to be have some kind of cancer, and he was in hospital and was unable to talk to him. And then the second one Chris talked to was Leo Gonneau. Mm-hmm. And so Chris mentioned to him, about I want to talk to you about what you might have saw on the bottom that night when you were diving in Shag Harbor looking for that UFO that supposedly crashed there. And he said to Chris, well, I wasn't anywhere near Shag Harbor. He says, we were off the mouth of Shelburne Harbor. That's where we were working on two objects that were on the bottom down there. Chris said, no, that's, he says, Shelburne's in, Shag Harbor's in Shelburne County. He says, yeah, he says, I know that. He says, but we weren't down in Shag Harbor at all. He says, that was another thing. We were doing our own thing up off of Cape Sable, or up off of Shelburne Harbor, which is where Government Point is. So whether that had anything to do with it or not, I don't know. Government Point had nobody knew it for years until 1986, I believe, was, or 87, when there was some kind of a scandal at the base there. By this time, it was a Canadian base, not the American base it used to be. Well, we were doing the same thing as they were, but we were looking after it now, which was where underwater microphone systems came ashore from the North Atlantic up over and around, right over across, Greenland and Iceland and all those places to track ships. Predominantly submarines, if they could get them, and they came ashore at Shelburne, at Government Point. And nobody knew anything about that. I've got a fellow now that worked there back in the day when the Shag Harbor incident went on, and he was unfamiliar with the incident itself, but other weird events that went on at the base, and he was an American at the time. It was 1967, 68, when they actually started to change over from American servicemen operating the equipment there to Canadian servicemen. Up until that time, the Canadians were, because it was thought to be a Canadian base, it was called CFS Shelburne, Canadian Forces Station Shelburne, and which was a dodge, to protect the Americans' secret operation there. They didn't want anybody to know about it. And what we did was our people were the people that did the guarding of the particular base there, and they operated the systems down there for keeping people happy, with the food system, cafeteria services, that sort of thing. And but anyway, that particular base was probably important. I would imagine, important to intelligence that nobody knew that these things were out there. And apparently here right offshore, maybe 2 miles and about, 80 feet of water, was apparently a couple of unidentified, I don't call them unidentified flying objects at this point, but there were submerged objects, unidentified, on the bottom. And we apparently had six or seven ships stationed over top of them, and we had divers going down to observe what they were doing. And this was what Leo Gonneau had stated when he first talked to Chris. Chris had an Army friend of his who's since passed away. That's the trouble with UFO cases that happened years ago. Same with Roswell. Like Stanton Friedman once said, it's always a race with the Undertaker to catch witnesses, you know, particularly on the older cases. But fortunately, when we were going at it, it was only like 23 or 25 years later. He stated that they had been using tanks and so on. They'd go down and they'd observe these two objects that were on the bottom, and one appeared, according to Leo Gonneau, to be lending assistance to the other. And he called them creatures. And Chris says, "What do you mean creatures?" He said, "These things." He says there were creatures there, and these things that were working underwater. And that's about as far as you go with it. The other witnesses that were involved in that turned out to be an aircraft identifier from the Canadian Air Force who could identify different aircraft just by pieces that came from, and that's not a reach. As a pilot myself, certain general aircraft I could probably, type of aircraft I could fly, I could probably see small pieces that can give you a rough idea of the size of the aircraft or what kind of an aircraft it might have come from. Not military aircraft or anything like that, but if you got an expert who's been working on military aircraft for years, he even said he was involved in the recovery of a U-2 off the south of Greenland that had crashed there and been taken out there in order to identify it as even in the RCAF. We knew about them. We knew what was going on with U-2s and so on. Of course, the whole world did after a certain point after Gary Powers got shot down and his over Russia that time. But this sort of weird stuff was going on all the time in the military, you know. And this sort of started to expand. You probably don't have the time for this, Martin, but I think I've explained this to you before about them. I want to get them in order now. I just mentioned the fellow who could identify aircraft, who was taken aboard a Canadian ship and kept out there for a week below decks, he said. And I said, Chris had said, what were you doing out there? You're in the Air Force. It was the Navy. He said, I was there in case they had identify aircraft parts. But he said, I never did find out what it was. He said, but I did hear an interesting conversation one night in the mess, aboard the ship, where an American officer was chewing out this Canadian diver for shooting his mouth off to his other divers, which was Leo Gonneau, because that's the type of guy he was, eh? And then, of course, that brought up the point, what was an American officer giving order, yelling at a Canadian sailor, on his own ship, But that was the second or third time that it happened, not necessarily with an American officer, but with an officer chewing out a rating or, a crewman on aboard an aircraft or anything like that for talking, in a sort of a public area, which was other military people, about something they'd seen, to do with this particular incident. So, again, it's just too detailed to get into, and you don't have the time for it on air, Martin, but a lot of that is in the book. Mm-hmm. But Leo, that was the first time Leo talked, Chris talked to him over the phone. And talked to him again once more, but he wanted to record this, so he asked him if he could come over and talk to him, to Leo. And Leo said, sure, I got nothing to hide. So he went over there, and he had a tape recorder with him, and he had a friend with him, the military fella. I believe the fellow's last name was McDonald. I have him on tape. I have McDonald and Chris, talking about it on tape. But anyway, they went over to Leo Gonneau's place, but when they got there, Leo was very jumpy. He said he'd checked with some of his friends at the base, and they told him to keep his mouth shut. And he shouldn't talk about this. So Chris sort of kept, questioning him, and he was goading him. And then finally the guy, Leo, told him, he said, no, I think you better leave, you know. So Chris couldn't push it any further. He made a last attempt to call him up on the phone. He says, I've got some recent documents. He said, maybe what you were talking about was this, that, and the other thing. Leo got all upset, and he said, no. He said, okay, you know, he started using bad language. You know, what you say, what you think. I know what I saw, and it wasn't any so-and-so Russian submarine and that sort of thing, you know, which is what their cover story was supposed to be. So we had to leave it at that. But then again, you know, there was the fellow who was there who could identify aircraft. He recorded that same argument that the Leo Gonneau had with the American officer about keeping his mouth shut about what they saw on the bottom. And Leo at the time had said, well, we all know it's not some blah, blah, blah Russian submarine. We know what we saw down there, you know, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then you got the, again, I'll let you ask the questions.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Just as someone had asked in their chat room a little while earlier, did they give any type of description of what the so-called beings look like?
No.
None at all?
Nothing. They just said creature.
Okay.
Yeah. He said, that was Leo, right? Now, there was other divers. They went down in pairs.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one diver who apparently was supposed to take pictures. And bear in mind, when you're in 80 feet of water and the water's off Nova Scotia, it's so full of plankton out there, that's why the fishing is so good, that the water, the visibility, I was a scuba diver myself for years. And when you're on the bottom, or even down, you don't have to go down to the bottom. The visibility is not much more than about 15 feet. So if there was two objects on the bottom, you'd have to be right on top of them to see both of them at the same time, because they just sort of disappear into the gloom, you know, just sitting there.
Yeah.
And so they were apparently taking pictures, underwater pictures, with another fella who since had moved to Cornwall, Ontario. And when we attempted to get a hold of him, Chris had tried, I tried, and neither time would he talk. He said, look, I'm not going to talk about it. I was going to keep my mouth shut about it, and I'm not going to talk about it.
Huh.
So that was the end of that. You can only push these things so far, mm-hmm. and you have a Freedom of Information Act in the United States that's much more open to getting information than what we have up here in Canada. When you want to get information, it's called access to information, and if you can get anybody to actually look, because they don't have a lot of people dedicated to do this sort of thing in our government up here, but and then normally they'll shut you down anyway. But in the last year, apparently, there's been some attempts to make our access to information a little bit more liberal and more informative, and put some teeth in it, you know, so that the public servants can't hide stuff from, you know, people that are trying to get information. Because it's not only us, it's the media, the press, the opposition parties at the time, you know, can't get information and so on.
Yeah.
And there's, of course, two other people involved there, the weapons expert and the ELINT crewman officer he was, who was in an Argus, what was called an Argus back, well, that's what they were, an Argus, a four-engine aircraft for maritime command that would could track submarines using those sonar buoys I was telling you about. And they were tracking these things from, he's the one that actually opened it up for me and gave me the, you know, the exact story of where these things were coming from, you know, the objects, and there was apparently two of them, again, coming down from Siberia and set off all kinds of alarms at NORAD. They scrambled aircraft out of North Bay, Ontario, and Goose Bay, Labrador. And in those days, in 67, it was RCF at that point, and which was a big deal. If you're going to scramble northward, F-104s northward, there's a good chance they weren't coming back because they didn't have much of a fuel supply. And they were coming down at apparently about 7,700 miles an hour. They thought, well, could be some kind of a new intercontinental ballistic missile coming over from Siberia, which would have been a good spot for them to come from if it was Russian. And but then they stopped somewhere over northern Canada and just stayed for like a couple of minutes. And that's when they stood the aircraft down, because they knew bloody well that there's no missile can do that. And then they proceeded onward at about 4,400 miles an hour, and eventually at least one of them ended up in the water at Shag Harbor, from what he said they tracked. We could never, ever get that from the nearby bases, but apparently from this guy, is what he told us. And, of course, he was supposed to do a show with Chris, and I was eventually in it myself, sightings. I don't know if you remember that. It was another UFO-related program down in the United States, and he was supposed to be on the show and or on that program on the very first episode, and he called up Chris and said he couldn't make it. And he talked at a very famous Canadian donut-type shop here, and coffee and donut, which is called Tim Hortons. And met Chris there. He showed up around 9 o'clock in the evening, and it was in October, believe it or not, with a hat, baseball hat and sunglasses on. He said to Chris that he couldn't do the show the next day, do the interview that he's supposed to do. Chris said, "Oh, geez, that's too bad. I was really depending on your testimony." He says, "I'm sorry, I can't do anything about it." And they parted. So, remember I mentioned when I was writing the book, I had to re-interview a bunch of people. So I got a hold of this fellow who, incidentally, lives about maybe 400 or 500 feet away from where I am right at this moment. And I contacted him, and he doesn't want his name mentioned. But back then, and, you know, asked him to repeat what he'd told Chris, and he told. And then I just hung up on him, and I thought I should ask him why he'd backed out. So I called him back, and I said, "Can you tell me why you backed out that night and wouldn't do the interview for sightings?" And he said, "Oh, yeah." He says, about 6 o'clock that evening when I was sitting down to have my supper. This guy was a contractor now, a pretty big contracting business. He said, the phone rang. My wife answered. He said, "It's for you, somebody from Ottawa." And he's you know, our Sarah Nation's capital. And when he got on the phone, this guy said, "I'm a ranking officer in the Department of National Defense, DND. And he said, "I understand you're doing an interview tomorrow, and I'm ordering you now, telling you now, not to do it. And so he said, "Well, okay," because he's an ex-RCAF crew member and actually an officer. And if they said no, that was the way it went. He said apparently the guy told him that he'd signed affidavits when he left the forces in 92, which is 5 years after the Shag Harbor thing, and that they were going to hold him to it, and you know, that he wouldn't disclose certain things, and this was apparently one of them.
Wow.
So I thought, well, that's pretty good. Now, if I have the time, if I do have the time, I got to tell you the other little story that backs that up.
Okay.
Is it all right? Yeah. Okay. So some years later, we're talking about 2001, 2002. A friend of mine, who was also ex-services, called me up and said he had an ex-services buddy of his who wanted to talk to me. He was retired as a major in the Canadian Army, and actually in Special Ops and so on. I said, "Yeah, sure, I'll talk to him." So I didn't know what it was all about. We met at a military base. Even though he was retired at this point, he could still go on the base, and there was a restaurant in the place, you know, a cafeteria in the place. So we went in, we had nice lunch and so on, and we were talking about, he wanted to know what I could tell him about a certain incident that happened to him, which I won't get involved in now. Because, you know, we spent a good hour on that. And the fact that he'd been in Vietnam during the Vietnam War as a Canadian Special Ops soldier, which I didn't even know we had any of those operating back then, but apparently we did, operating a layout out of Laos into Vietnam. And so the other fellow that had invited me to meet with him in the first place, Art is his first name. I don't think he'd mind me giving you his first name, who's a civil engineer now, said Don's had, you know, quite an experience, him and Cristal's, with the Shag Harbor incident. And I said, "Yeah, we used to have a lot of trouble with you guys back in the, you know, in the day. Well, you know, we probably still do about covering things up and so on." I said, "One of them," he says, "Well, how so?" And I mentioned about this fellow that I was telling about, the Atlanta electronic intelligence officer, okay, on aboard Argus, you know, had mentioned that he had been told not to do an interview about something he'd been involved with back in 1967 by a ranking officer in Ottawa. He says, oh, yeah, I've done that. I said, what do you mean? You've told people not to talk about UFOs. He said, no, not about UFOs. He said, but I have been ordered to call somebody who was had been in the forces or either may perhaps still was, identify myself as a ranking officer with DND in Ottawa, and we're telling you not to talk about this. And I was floored, to be honest. I mean, here I actually had corroboration of what this other fellow had told me. You know, and it doesn't get any clearer than that. And this guy, I mean, I know who he was, you know. I can't mention his name because he's a very well-known person in Nova Scotia, and he probably didn't want to have, because he had his own UFO sighting, and I don't think he wanted anybody to talk about it. Beyond me, he was just trying to, he wanted me to explain it to him because it was the same old story. He'd had this event happen to him, and it had bothered him for years and years and years and wanted some answers about it. Well, we know the Vietnam War was in the 60s to 74, right? And that's when this had happened to him. So this is many years he'd been, this had been gnawing at him. So I was happy to be able to tell him, you know, you're in good company because, you know, there's literally thousands of people have the same problem. So anyway, I had that corroboration. I wanted to get that one out. It's one of my more interesting stories, which didn't show up in the book because it happened long after the book was published.
Wow.
So.
Wow. Okay, good. So now I'm sure you heard about, and I know you're not involved with the society, you know, the Sag Harbor Incident Society, but I know that you did hear about the funding. There was an anonymous donor that donated some money to keep it going, which I think is great. And the reason that the donor had was that it's too important. The case is too important, and he thinks that, you know, something is, you know, might still come out of that. Do you feel the same way, that something may still come out of Shag Harbor?
Yeah, well, what are we at? We're 50 years now. And, you know, the people that were in their, you know, in their 20s then are in their 70s now. 30s, good chance if they were in their 30s at that age, their days are becoming numbered and so on. Again, you know, in a race with the Undertaker. And if anybody, and it's strangely enough, it happens. I mean, from time to time, I'll get somebody to contact me and say, I just read your book, or I saw the documentary you did on such and such, and I've done, I don't know how many of those now, pretty close to 40 by now, I think. And somebody will contact me because, you know, they saw me doing this thing, and they say, you know, I had this happen to me, or I had that happen to me, or something happened to my father, you know, and I've got some, you know, maybe some clippings here or something. And he still won't talk about it to this day. And that sort of thing, you know, goes on. So these people do still come out who, strangely enough, hadn't ever heard of the, I mean, it's, to me, it seems odd that everybody hasn't heard about the Shag Harbor, but that's because I've been, you know, up to my neck in it for, you know, 25 years now. Well, I guess pretty close to it anyway, 20 odd years. And so if anybody's got anything out there, you know, we want to hear about it. Even people, I was contacted by a fellow who'd been training in Maine, and I forget which base now it was now. I can't even remember. You know, and I've flown over Maine lots of times, or landed there in Bangor, or, you know, down in Augusta or those places. I'm trying to think of the name of that base where it was. It was on the East Coast anyway, and they had seen, well, they were training over there, and they were using prop-driven aircraft originally training. I think he was training with the Coast Guard, and they had he recalled that particular time base of 1967, and they had seen odd instances of things going on over towards Shag Harbor, because where they're at, you know, you're across the bay, Gulf of Maine there, but you're not that far away from Nova Scotia. It's only, you know, maybe 70 miles across the water, if that, at the very southwestern tip. I could look it up on Google now, but I don't want to take your time.
Not too far.
But you know where it is. Yeah. I mean, when I was living down in I had built a summer home. Well, it wasn't winter. It was a house down there in Meliga Lake in Nova Scotia. I was basically across from on the same latitude as I'm trying to remember the president's place down there. It starts with a K.
Not Kennebunk.
Yeah. Kennebunk, yeah. Yeah, it was on the same latitude as that. Okay. Right? I'm not saying there was any kind of a UFO incident there. I'm just saying that my house was on the same latitude, Kennebunk, yeah. Maine, right? So, but anyway, so this particular person had called up and said him and his radar guy in the back, and they were in a still it was a prop driven aircraft. I'm tending to think it was like an Avenger or something like that, as a trainer, and seen weird lights in the sky over towards that, and he contacted me some years later. And he gave me a little bit of information. I pushed him to stay in touch because I wanted to get some. I asked him a bunch of questions online, and he never answered. And a lot of times these people get frightened off because they're afraid their name will come out, you know, and maybe they'll be either ridiculed or maybe he was still in the forces then, you know, when this happened. And so you've always got to be careful of that. I've had that happen so many times to me, it's not funny. And it's unfortunate, too, because you get some good information. Sometimes it sticks. A lot of times it doesn't.
Yes. Now, eventually, these craft, did people actually see them come out of the water and take off?
Well, there's a document by Lachlan Cameron from the RCMP. That's 7 days later down in Woods Harbor. You know, I mentioned that before. When you're in the northern end of Woods Harbor, you're practically at the Irish Moss Plant. I mean, we're talking a few hundred feet or so. But they were in their home, and the TV went a little wonky. I think they were watching Ed Sullivan or something. Couldn't have been Ed Sullivan because it was Wednesday night. So anyway, they were watching a program on TV back then. It was on Rabbit Ears, right? 67. Some company had come along with their children as well, and he went outside to try to maybe fix the antenna, and they watched two objects climbing away from the water upwards from basically the same area where the other ones had gone in, off in the sound off of Shea Harbor. And they sort of went up, hovered for a little bit, and then turned around and went off over the Gulf of Maine over towards the mainland of the United States. There might have been a UFO report or something down there that night, who knows. But there was two of them. They had the lights around the rim, you know, and so on and so forth. So whether that had anything to do, it's pretty odd if it was the case. I mean, it was the same area, and it was exactly a week later. And about 9 o'clock, 9 to 9:30 in the evening. So I think that's the one you're referring to, and it's in the RCMP document there, which is basically a telex.
And did you say earlier that they actually, there was another question that came in that said, do you think there is sonar evidence of these underwater objects moving? But did you already address that?
Well, sort of. The sonar buoys, they were apparently tracking these things when they went up the coast. The Shelburne component of this thing almost lends me to believe that there were people knew there was something going on before the air desk in Ottawa, which was the RCAF itself anyway, in Ottawa knew what was going on, or maybe they did know at the time, but they had to sort of keep a public face going at the same time. They had, what do they call it? There's a name for that, undercover, but not exactly that word.
Covert?
You know, and I won't say it undercover.
Yeah.
Overt, yeah, exactly. Good for you. I'm getting old now, losing all those words. And there were so many little different things going on that seemed to be really well prepared ahead of time, you know, that, you know, these things were on them right off the bat, you know, they were in the water. Now, just to say this, to be fair, Chris and I can't be 100% sure that the dates match up for Shelburne and Shea Harbor. But there's so many people, well, not so many, but enough people saying that it did, you know, the witnesses themselves, all put it in to the same time frame as what was going on over at Shea Harbor. They'd refer to, well, you know, that other thing was going on over at Shea Harbor while this thing was going on, you know. And we'd get that kind of, but never anybody that could nail it down for us. There is one RCMP document out there that we call the X-File because it's the only one we've ever seen that actually had an X in the file number. And with Leo Howard Mercy, who had a the MV Nickerson, which was a longliner fishing boat. It had a radar and everything on it, and they had been watching some objects in the sky. And while he was out there, he got a call from the Coast Guard saying the RCMP wanted him to drop into their detachment in Lunenburg when he go to shore the next time, and this document was a testament to that, where he told them what they'd seen in the sky, how these things had gone again on the same night as the Sieg Hermansen, and maybe this is the same thing that was going on over at Sieg Harbor or in Shelburne. Now, Shelburne could mean two things, either the county of Shelburne or the town of Shelburne. Shelburne itself has a pretty nice little harbor. It's not like Halifax, but it was the alternate base for non-capital ships, like destroyers and corvettes and all that sort of thing. They could actually work from there because there's railroad connecting Halifax to there. The old Southwestern Railroad was connected to Shelburne and so on at that time. In an emergency case, because as I mentioned to you before, the northwestern end of the northern section of Halifax was pretty much wiped off the map during the Halifax explosion in 1917, in December 6th. On December 6th, 1917.
Yeah, just before you move on, how did that, was that explosion any part of somehow World War One, or how did that happen?
Yeah, well, what happened there was the IMO and the Mont Blanc, which were two vessels. One was loaded with munitions heading over, like I mentioned, Halifax's staging area to go to Europe during the Second World War, or during the First World War and the Second World War, but this is the First World War we're talking about. And it had benzene, gas, and all kinds of stuff on board, but there was also high-energy explosives and so on in this thing, and it got T-boned by the IMO, and it was on fire. And it was in what's called the Narrows at the north end of the harbor, which goes into a big basin, Bedford Basin, which is where I live, actually. I live right on the edge of it here, and it's a big round circular area. And they were putting crews together to go out and fight this thing that was a fire off. Both of them were drifting in a fire in the Narrows. And then all of a sudden, the Mont Blanc blew. And, I mean, it was, like I said, it was the biggest man-made explosion up until they dropped the bomb in Hiroshima. Some of the American nuclear science that were building the A-bomb had come from Los Alamos up to Halifax during the Second World War to look at old pictures of Halifax and the explosive effect of this thing going off in the harbor, because they were trying to determine what was the best way to set off the A-bomb, whether they should do an air shot or let it hit the ground or whatever. And because that was the only one they actually had where there was evidence of it, you know. So when it went off, it immediately killed about 1,600 people, and then eventually 2,000 people died. It blinded something like 600 or 700, because people were standing in their windows, and they're in schools, and buildings, office buildings, and all this sort of thing. There's probably, I don't know, 50,000-70,000 people in the city of Halifax back in World War One when this thing went off. But fortunately, it went off. The land goes upwards, you know, into quite a hill there. And the Narrows goes just a bit around that hill, so a lot of the explosive power of the thing was deflected by the hill, so it didn't get down right into the city. It got into the north end of the city.
Wow. It's funny. You'd think you'd hear a lot about something like that, but you really don't.
Yeah.
Don, we're out of time already.
Out of time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I want to thank.
Very interesting.
I want to thank you so much, and I really look forward to meeting you come October.
Yeah, okay, we will be down. I'll be down.
Yeah,
sure.
Excellent.
And I look forward to seeing you, Martin. We've talked a couple of times now, so good to press the flesh.
Yes, exactly.
You know?
All right, you take care now.
Yeah, okay.
All right.
You too.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Okay, everyone. I'm not sure why that music is going, but let me stop it. Thanks so much for... listening to the show this evening, and I really appreciate it. And next week, we have Ben Hurl from Australia. He's going to be on, And so that will be next week at the same time right here. And if you were in the chat room on YouTube watching it live, thank you so much. And if you support the show, thank you so much as well. And all right, we'll see you here next week.